Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we're moving forward with or without you folks, and I'm not a YouTube fan, so just so you know, I'm just saying with or without you. Anyway, Paul, welcome back, and we are, we kind of wrapped up a cumbersome process, but this is where they were basically kind of going through the Virginia plan and making changes and so forth. And they kind of continued on. So what we're going to do, so that you kind of understand the narrative, because this is a committee trying to pound out a document, a product. Mm-hmm. And they knew this was going to be a big body of work, that these men were not given a commission that basically limited them to 2 weeks. This right. was not a commission. Nowhere in there was there a limitation of time. And as a matter of fact, there was a lot of people that I think were jumping in. And as a matter of fact, we'll share this probably towards the end, if not maybe, at the very end, maybe sooner. But what I want to do is I want to help people understand that there were men that were in this meeting that were somewhat tied to the Anti-Federalist movement. They were very reluctant with what was going on. Mm-hmm. And they participated, and they even made suggestions and so forth. But some of them actually stood up and questioned their commission. And a few of the people, one of the key anti-federalists was a gentleman from New York. And I forget which one it was, but I mean, and there were some other ones too. But anyway, and I believe he brings up the commission point. And I think Mr. Patterson does as well, but he only did that because he felt that they were, you know, going to, and as a matter of fact, remember, I don't think we provided this to the audience yet, but I think I showed you how down the road, I think it was like in July or actually early August, where they actually started producing the Constitution in its original form. It looked like the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
And it morphed from, you know, 1 to 20 articles into 6. Mm-hmm. And that was the work of these men, because it started making more sense to co-locate and centralize. And so one of the things that they did was they centralized the powers, and they created the enumeration of powers. In other words, when people say that they're reading Article 1 or Article 2 or Article 3 or 4 or 5 or mm-hmm. so forth, that was not an enumerated power. The enumerated powers were clearly listed in Article 1, Section 8. So when somebody says that they have the power to regulate state land, they don't. It's mm-hmm. not listed there.
Right.
Right. So where do they have any power? And the only thing that is listed is the type of land that they have the power to possess.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we're going to go through all of this, and it's going to be interesting, folks, because this is how they debated what the Constitution would mean in its form and so forth. Now, one of the things we've done already is we've already read through the ratification debates, and I'm hoping that everybody, as they read go through this with us and the ratification debates, you're going to realize that all of these men that were testifying in Pennsylvania, in New York, in the Carolinas, in Virginia, and so forth, in Massachusetts, they all heard the same arguments, and that's why they articulated it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why the Constitution was undefeated. It was ratified in every state that it was debated.
Yeah, well, I think the other thing is they had articulated these arguments before as we were reading the previous documents, that which is why it sounded like maybe one voice. They had articulated them so many times that all the states were familiar with this terminology, and that's what impresses me.
Right.
You know, because they don't have the technology, you know, we do today where they can, you know, send a PDF, you know, all over the place. They literally, this was in their minds, okay? They traveled on horseback and still were saying the same thing because they all knew that there were challenges with the articles, that if they didn't resolve them, the nation would probably be dissolved. You know, they knew they had a serious issue to deal with.
Right. Right. So what we're doing today now is we're actually starting with the New Jersey plan. And this is June 15th. And as a matter of fact, the convention literally just kicked off. And okay. Actually, what happened Thursday, the day before, it was a very short day because there's only one entry in convention. And it says, Mr. Patterson observed to the convention that it was the wish of several deputations, particularly that of New Jersey, that further time might be allowed them to contemplate the plan reported from the committee of the whole and to digest one purely federal and contradistinguished from the reported plan. He said they hope to have such an one ready by tomorrow to be laid before the convention, and the convention adjourned. In other words, on Thursday, they said, okay, well, let's go shopping, and you guys get ready to present the plan tomorrow.
Okay.
It was a very short day, and right. So the next day, everybody came with bated breath to hear Mr. Patterson and what he was going to present as the New Jersey plan. So go ahead and let's kick this thing off.
New Jersey plan.
Yep.
Mr. Patterson laid before the convention the plan which he said several of the deputations wish to be substituted in place of that proposed by Mr. Randolph. After some little discussion of the most proper mode of giving it a fair deliberation, it was agreed that it should be referred to a committee of the whole, and that in order to place the two plans in due comparison, the other should be recommitted. At the earnest desire of Mr. Lansing and some other gentlemen, it was also agreed that the convention should not go into committee of the whole on the subject till tomorrow, by which delay the friends of the plan proposed by Mr. Patterson would be better prepared to explain and support it, and all would have the opportunity of taking copies. Okay, these weren't Xerox copies either. All right, so this apparently they understood this had to take time.
Right, there you go.
The propositions from New Jersey moved by Mr. Patterson were in the words following. 1. Resolved that the Articles of Confederation ought to be so revised, corrected, and enlarged as to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union.
Okay, so what he just said was basically what was in everybody's commission. This was their responsibility. Okay, so I don't know how they were interpreting this as, you know, not to do what they were doing. So go ahead.
Right. Sure. So it said Articles of Confederation, but it said so revised, corrected, and enlarged as well. So, okay. 2, resolved that in addition to the powers vested in the United States in Congress by the present existing Articles of Confederation, they be authorized to pass acts for raising a revenue by levying a duty or duties on all goods or merchandises of foreign growth or manufacture imported into any part of the United States by stamps on paper, vellum, or parchment, and by postage on all letters or packages passing through the General Post Office to be applied to such federal purposes as they shall deem proper and expedient, to make rules and regulations for the collection thereof, and the same from time to time to alter and amend in such manner as they shall think proper, to pass acts for the regulation of trade and commerce as well with foreign nations as with each other, provided that all punishments, fines, forfeitures, and penalties to be incurred for contravening such acts and regulations shall be adjudged by the common law judiciaries of the state in which any offense contrary to the true intent and meaning of such acts, rules, and regulations shall have been committed or perpetrated, with liberty of commencing in the first instance all suits and prosecutions for that purpose in the superior common law judiciary in such state, subject nevertheless for the correction of all errors, both in law and fact, in rendering judgment to an appeal to the judiciary of the United States. Is that one sentence?
Well, so there's a colon in there. Yeah, it looks like one sentence. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one sentence, it's several paragraphs, but it's about 12 lines.
Uh-huh.
So I get to take a breath.
You just have to learn how to breathe through your nose.
Right. Three, resolve that whenever requisition shall be necessary, instead of the rule for making requisitions mentioned in the Articles of Confederation, the United States in Congress be authorized to make such requisitions in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians not paying taxes, that if such requisitions be not complied with in the time specified therein, to direct the collection thereof in the non-complying states, and for that purpose to devise and pass acts directing and authorizing the same, provided that none of these powers hereby vested in the United States and Congress shall be exercised without the consent of at least blank states. And in that proportion of the number of confederated states should hereafter be increased or diminished. Okay. Notice he used the term confederated states. Well, that's because they're used to the term Articles of Confederation. That's
right.
What they were. Four, resolve that the United States and Congress be authorized to elect a federal executive to consist of blank number of persons to continue in the office for a term of blank number of years, to receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase or diminution shall be made so as to affect the persons composing the executive at the time of such increase or diminution to be paid out of the federal treasury, to be incapable of holding any other office or appointment during their time of service and for blank years thereafter, to be ineligible a second time and removable by Congress on application by a majority of the executives of the several states, that the executives, besides their general authority to execute the federal acts, ought to appoint all federal offices not otherwise provided for, and to direct all military operations, provided that none of the persons composing the federal executive shall on any occasion take command of any troops who is personally to conduct any enterprise as general or in other capacity. You know, I'm hearing language here that did get into the Constitution.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And as a matter of fact, these were common parts. Remember, when we read the Articles of Confederation, you know, I was pointing out, hey, that language is actually in the Constitution.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Five. Resolve that a federal judiciary be established to consist of a supreme tribunal, the judges of which to be appointed by the executive, and to hold their offices during good behavior, to receive punctually at stated times a fixed compensation for their services, in which no increase or diminution shall be made, so as to affect the persons actually in office at the time of such increase or diminution. That the judiciary so established shall have authority to hear and determine in the first instance on all impeachments of federal officers and by way of appeal in the dernier resort. I don't know what dernier resort is. Do you?
Well, I'd have to look it up. So keep reading. I'll let you know.
Okay. So, and by way of appeal in the dernier resort in all cases touching the rights of ambassadors, in all cases captures from an enemy, in all cases of piracies and felonies on the high seas, in all cases in which foreigners may be interested in the construction of any treaty or treaties, or which may arise on any of the acts for blank regulation of trade, or the collection of the federal revenue that none of the judiciary shall, during the time they remain in office, be capable of receiving or holding any other office or appointment during their time of service for or for blank thereafter. Resolved, that all acts of the United States and Congress made by virtue and in pursuance of the powers hereby and by the Articles of Confederation vested in them, and all treaties made and ratified under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the respective states, so far forth as those acts and treaties shall relate to the said states or their citizens, and that the judiciary of the several states shall be bound thereby in their decisions, anything in their respective laws of the individual states the contrary notwithstanding, and that if any state or any body of men in any state shall oppose or prevent, what is that abbreviation, propose or prevent carrying into execution such acts or treaties, the federal executive shall be authorized to call forth the power of the confederated states or so much thereof as may be necessary to enforce and compel an obedience to such acts or in observance of such treaties. 7. Resolved that the provision be made for the admission of new states into the Union. 8. Resolved the rule of naturalization ought to be by the same in every state. 9. Resolved that a citizen of one state committing an offense in another state of the Union shall be deemed guilty of the same offense as if it had been committed by a citizen of the state in which the offense was committed.
Okay. So that was their submitted plan.
Okay.
Now what I'm going to provide is actually out of a different source. For whatever reason, it was not included in Madison's notes, the following language that actually came from Sherman, which was considered the Sherman Compromise.
Mm-hmm.
I looked.
Okay.
It just wasn't noted. I don't know if Madison left, because if he wasn't there, he didn't capture it.
Sure.
And so
here's a question. Are you saying the Sherman plan was considered, but Madison didn't get it in the notes?
Correct.
Okay.
So Madison, probably maybe he had to, you know, use the restroom, whatever.
Okay.
Right.
And so you've got the source for this.
Yes.
And we've inserted it, and this is the Sherman plan. So
yes.
You want me to
go
share
ahead.
That?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, actually, what you're going to read is kind of an introduction from, you know, whoever captured this.
Okay.
And I believe it was Sherman himself, but go ahead.
All right. Among the Sherman papers was found a document containing a series of propositions which has been variously interpreted. The members of the Connecticut delegation to the Federal Convention had served upon several different committees of Congress that had proposed amendments to the Articles of Confederation, and this document embodies some of the amendments thus proposed. L.H. Boutell, in his Life of Roger Sherman, treats it as having been prepared in the latter part of Sherman's service in Congress and, quote, as embodying the amendments which he deemed necessary to be made to the existing government, end quote. Bancroft, on the other hand, regards it as a plan of government presented to the Federal Convention, quote, which in importance stands next to Virginia, end quote. Neither of these interpretations is acceptable to the editor, who is inclined to consider this document as more probably presenting the ideas of the Connecticut delegation in forming the New Jersey plan. It is accordingly reprinted here and is as follows. Description. Ferrand writes, quote, among the Sherman papers was found a document containing a series of propositions which has been variously interpreted. The members of the Connecticut delegation to the Federal Convention had served upon several different committees of Congress that had proposed amendments to the Articles of Confederation, and this document embodies some of the amendments thus proposed.
Yeah, so actually you're rereading what was already there. I just realized that was just a duplication.
Okay,
go ahead.
Roger Sherman?
Yeah, so go ahead. I'm actually going to delete that.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
All right.
Roger Sherman.
Roger Sherman, that in addition to the legislative powers vested in Congress by the Articles of Confederation, the legislature of the United States be authorized to make laws to regulate the commerce of the United States through with foreign nations and among the several states in the Union, to impose duties on foreign goods and commodities imported into the United States and on papers passing through the post office for raising a revenue, and to regulate the collection thereof, and apply the same to the payment of the debts due from the United States and for supporting the government.
Okay, so let's stop right there. He was introducing things that were actually incorporated into the Constitution. And one, the Commerce Clause is very important. So did he not separate the regulating of commerce with foreign nations and then identify the becoming the traffic cop among the states?
Well, that's what he says. Make laws to regulate the commerce of the United States with foreign nations. And then he says, and Among the several states.
Then he talks about these duties. But the other thing he points out is, and on paper. So they're adding a tax on papers passing through the post office for raising a revenue and to regulate the collection thereof. In other words, he's talking about, so when you're looking at the taxation, it was about this taxation of regulating mail so that they could basically, dictate the collection, which in the old days, the collection process was done at a general post office.
Okay.
And so the post roads were really the roads of how the carrier would basically, go to dispatch or to deliver these wads of mail that were going to that post office, to the next post office. When they talk about post roads, that wasn't the roads that went to your house.
Right. This is the roads between post offices.
Right. Which is why there was no power given Congress to make and improve the roadways, only to dictate to the state which roads they would use in carrying the mail.
And so here's a question, and that is to impose duties.
That's one of the reasons why every time Congress tried to create a Department of Transportation, they said, hey, look, the establishment of post roads isn't us building roads. It's basically telling the state which roads that they had we were going to use.
Right.
Right.
So here on papers, tax on papers passing through the post office, I thought that was unusual because isn't that postage? I mean, they had to cover the cost of moving these papers through the post office.
Yes.
It's just unusual to see that.
And who knows? They may have, I don't know. I've never done a real deep dive on the handling of post and mail in the United States, but they could have actually charged people for the delivery of the mail as well. Because, they may have been collecting the taxes on receiving and delivering of mail in these big cities, but as you got out, who paid for that post office person that was sitting out in this small little town that only served a few people? Did the federal government pay for that, or was there a revenue captured as well? We got to send this, so you captured that revenue. But what about on the delivery side?
So here's a question I had, and pictures of, images that we have these days of the old post office.
Oh, we just ran out of time. So keep that picture in your head. And so thank you so much. I appreciate it. That snuck up on us, didn't it? So we're in the process of the Sherman Plan. And obviously, I have a lot of focus on this because this was the big compromise. This was what, helped bridge the two plans, the New Jersey plan, as well as the Virginia plan. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Now, you know, so as I've been going through this, I have found these gaps. Like, there was no mention at all. I believe the Pinckney plan was actually put before the committee, but Madison just didn't capture it. And so maybe, remember we talked about, you know, Madison being a little biased, you know, in what he was doing. He had to be making decisions whether he was going to put quill to parchment or, you know, pen to paper on a particular issue or not, and whether he captured it or not. So I think that he didn't even entertain the Pinckney plan, not that it wasn't presented. He just didn't capture it.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, the same thing happened here. Now, I find it interesting that he captured as much as he did of the Hamilton plan. So okay. Anyway, all right. So the next paragraph is where he goes on. Actually, you were saying something, though. So
I'm trying to remember what I was saying, though. It may come back to me. Let me see.
So we were talking about post roads.
Talking about post roads and post office. Oh, I remember my question. So for those of us who live in the 21st century and maybe, you know, from watching TV, we've got images of the old post office in which people went to the general store, okay? Not a postal building, but the general store to pick up their mail. That was kind of the meeting place.
Right. Yep.
Okay. And in fact, I remember my dad telling me about this. You know, he lived out in the country with his grandfather for a while. And that's what they did. They went to the store to pick up the mail. So, you know, then that leads to the question is, you know, were these general stores a contractor for the mail? Okay. And so things were simpler, but no, you didn't. Well, you know what? I'm wrong. I'm wrong about that, because now that I think of it, my dad told me that he would. They did get their mail delivered.
Okay, so you may be wrong about it, but you were right about it.
What do you mean?
Well, I actually grew up in an area where the general store actually was the post office as well.
Wow.
And okay. That what ended up happening was, again, they didn't create the needful buildings for the post offices. They used an existing. So what would happen, it's kind of like a person who is a notary of the public, mm-hmm. right? That's an official title. That is a government title. You're appointed by the government, and you have some very legal obligations to do that. And you can do that at home. And the whole point is, a notary public is a service you can sell, and right. You can actually have an office or what have you, or you can be a traveling notary, but it doesn't matter. And I think that the same thing was applied to the post office. And you're right, the general store was the thing that was operating on a regular basis. In other words, Monday through Friday, you know, it had mm-hmm. business hours. And so they needed to have a post office in a place that did that. Now, sure. They probably could have put it in a saloon, but they didn't.
Right.
Because I guess kids couldn't go into saloons to pick up the mail for mom and dad.
Right.
And so they had to put it in a place that was not age, you know, there was no age discrimination.
Not age limited, right.
And they didn't put it in churches because churches weren't necessarily open 5 days a week either.
Right. But everybody had to go to the store.
It just made sense to use the general store because right. every town had at least a general store.
Correct.
And so okay. maybe in the bigger cities, they had maybe a special building because they had that kind of volume. But when you're talking about a town of, you know, 40 people,
right,
there wasn't a lot of volume. Right. So what ended up happening is I think the general store, the clerk of the store, charged mm-hmm. maybe a penny or whatever it was for the receipt and or the delivery of, and they kept the books on that and how to do that. I again, this is one of those things that nobody's ever really done a, you know, a full discovery on the, you know, our postal system, how it originally operated and how it moved forward into this huge dynasty that I believe is now owned by Britain, by the crown.
I've heard that, and that would, I find that irritating. I hope that's not correct, but.
I actually heard this not from, you know, a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. I actually heard this from our postal carrier in California.
Wow.
So, I mean, I considered the source and go, well, they probably would know.
Yeah, they probably would. And, you know, I had to share that, you know, I worked for the post office for a little while.
Uh-huh.
My dad retired from the post office. My brother retired from the post office. It turned out not to be my line of work. If you're inside, it's very repetitive. Okay.
Yep.
And that wasn't me. But one of the things that I did discover, and my dad pointed this out to me, is that the post office delivers in one day more mail and more packages than UPS, FedEx, and the other services combined deliver in a year.
Yeah.
So they do, I think they do an amazing service. I know because I've seen it from the inside.
Right.
But just an aside that, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, no, so the paradigms are shifting. And as a matter of fact, I remember somebody was kidding me that FedEx and UPS were merging. But anyway, there was a joke to it. But nevertheless, let's go ahead and move forward.
Okay. So I think the next paragraph was
to make laws yeah.
binding on the people of the United States and on the courts of law and other magistrates and officers, civil and military, within the several states, in all cases which concern the common interests of the United States, but not to interfere with the government of the individual states in matters of internal police with respect to the government of such states only and wherein the general welfare of the United States is not affected. So something stands out to me here, and that's the word police.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't expecting to see this. Because, you know, you've done some, you know, exposés on the police and where they started.
Uh-huh.
I suppose it was a word, but what would you think they mean here? They didn't necessarily have police the way we think them today, do they? Did they?
Well, so there were sheriffs that were keepers right. of the law.
Okay.
And then the sheriff had a posse and or deputies. Now, in some areas, they may have had deputies because there were so many people that could fund that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is government, and it costs money to create laws. It costs money to enforce laws.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the people had to pay that. So they didn't have what we would call a police department.
Okay.
It was managed by law enforcement. So when the federal government created their police force, they actually created an entity that kind of did that, but it was a leadership entity instead of a thug squad.
Okay.
And what I mean by that was they created the U.S. Marshal.
Mm-hmm.
And the marshal was dependent upon the sheriff, and the sheriff's deputies.
Correct.
They didn't create an FBI. The reason that marshals were created were and assigned to states. And they were the ones that actually went out and made sure that the apportionment of taxation. And I mean, that's why we learn that it was a marshal that was going out to all the whiskey, you know, producers to say, okay, you need to pay this tax.
Sure.
And so that's how they, you know, went about it, was a marshal. And if the marshal was getting resistance, he had to go to the sheriff. Because why? Because the enforcement of the execution of law, which is the enforcement of law, is to be done by the militia.
Correct.
So when the state had these requisitions, the sheriff would actually have to go and say, hey, you got to pay. And if he, if he got a bunch of resistance, then he'd have to draw upon his posse and or the militia.
Right.
Same.
Okay.
Okay.
And well, the other thing I read about marshals, because I had wondered, you know, what their role was and something about their history. And I believe marshals were, I'm trying to remember if they were either even recommended by George Washington, because the other thing they did was it was their role to deliver people to the court. Okay, they were kind of court police.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was the U.S. Marshals in very rural areas where a judge, you know, didn't travel. In other words, and actually they captured this in a lot of old westerns where the marshal actually had a carriage that with bars that would go in and, you know, grab the Yahoo that committed the crime to take him to the judge to be tried.
So there is, you may not be familiar with it, there is a new series. It's called Bass Reeves, U.S. Marshal. And that's, this guy was an actual individual. He was, in fact, he was so successful, he was black, and he was so successful as a U.S. Marshal that his deeds are legendary.
Yeah, was this in Colorado?
It may have been.
I've heard about this. I've heard some interesting stories about it. Yes.
Yeah, I may have actually started in Texas. But what it is, in the series, the judge actually assigns Bass Reeves to go bring this guy, you know, capture this guy and bring him to court or whatever, you know. And that was his job. And incidentally, he was so successful at disguise and stuff that they originally they say that his story is what the Lone Ranger is based on. It's a current series. I think it's in its second season. It's very interesting. I haven't watched them all, but
sounds interesting. It's something I'm very interested in because I've heard that name before. But anyway, let's keep on this.
Okay, so where are we? I read the second paragraph, didn't I? Okay.
All right. So go ahead.
That the laws of the United States ought, as far as may be consistent with the common interests of the Union, to be carried into execution by the judiciary and executive officers in the respective states where the execution thereof is required. So when they say judiciary and executive officers.
So this is the forming of how this is going to be carried out throughout the states and so forth, and that is clarified in the powers that it goes to the militia, right?
Okay.
Keep going.
Okay, that the legislature of the United States be authorized to institute one supreme tribunal in such and such other tribunals as they may judge necessary for the purpose aforesaid to ascertain their respective powers and jurisdictions. I want to stop here for just a second and ask a question, because I believe it was yesterday or the day before you said something about the courts making their own rules. Or I'm trying to remember just what you said, or actually defining this, you know, the inferior courts. I think that's not. Is that right? Because Congress is supposed to determine what the inferior courts were. And I'm trying to remember what it was you were saying.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, they're supposed to, Congress is supposed to establish the rules and their procedures and so forth. And so that would, you know, we just have to dive into Article 3.
Right.
And Article 3 kind of talks about that there should be one. And if you kind of start looking at, you know, the inclusion of Congress, it says the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. In other words, they're going to grant them what, you know, how many courts and how they're going to function.
Correct. So in okay. other words, it shouldn't be the court that determines how the court functions. It should be the representatives of the people who determine how the court
right,
functions.
Right, because we are a Republican form of government, not a okay. court form of
right.
government. Okay.
Right. I wanted to capture that.
In all cases affecting, so this is Article 1, Section 2, and this is the second to last paragraph. In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, and those in which cases in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. And so and there's one more mention of Congress regulating the court, literally the next paragraph in Section 2, and it states, the trial of all crimes except in cases of impeachment shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crime shall have been committed. But when not committed within the state, the trial shall be in such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed. So in other words, the court, you know, has some, you know, big responsibilities, but Congress has to dictate a lot of that mm-hmm. as far as their processes, what they can do and what they can't, as far as regulating of the court, their rules have to come from Congress, not from themselves. So when they started granting themselves these rules of how they were going to behave in mm-hmm. injecting case law and precedents in 1837, Congress should have stepped up and said, hold on here. You
right.
can't do that. But they accepted these rules as of the record of how the court would move forward. This was the opening of the door of empowering the court to let the court take care of the legal battles from challenges from the states.
By the way.
So that they could serve their agenda. Go ahead.
So by the way, just because Congress allowed it doesn't mean it's valid.
That's true. Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and right. so just because the Supreme Court wants to redefine something that's constitutional or change their processes, like injecting case law and precedents, doesn't mean it's legitimate. So that when they in the fact that they've done that and they've used case law and precedents means that every single one of those cases where they've created a ruling, all those rulings are defunct. So, anyway, let's just keep moving forward, because at this point, we are in the next paragraph.
And that's that the legislatures, right?
That the legislature...
Of the individual states ought not to possess a right to emit bills of credit for a currency.
No. The legislature's the one above that.
Oh, that the legislature of the United States be authorized to institute one supreme tribunal and such other tribunals as they may judge necessary for the purpose aforesaid, and ascertain their respective powers and jurisdictions.
Okay, and then the next one.
That the legislatures of the individual states ought not to possess a right to emit bills of credit for a currency. Chair, can I stop here?
Yeah.
I had this question for you last week, okay? Because...
Well, the answer is the same.
Yeah, I know, but I wanted to share it publicly.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Because it's if a state is not allowed to emit bills of credit, isn't it what bond issues are?
No. A bill of credit is paper currency.
Okay.
In other words, here when they created our currency, the federal currency. Mm-hmm. You know, so basically what they did was they said, okay, you've already created bills of currency. Moving forward, you cannot emit bills of credit or paper currency.
Okay.
That the United States currency will slowly migrate to gold and silver coin.
And paper currency was considered bills of credit, which is what we're awash in right now.
Yes.
Right?
Correct. Well, okay. So when they started creating bills of credit, if you want to call it that, it was actually to reduce the amount of coin that you carried. But for every bill, there was an associated piece of metal for that currency or that paper in circulation, so that at any point in time, the holder of that bill could go to a bank and exchange it for gold or silver.
So now you just led into my next question. So paper currency, even if it was backed by gold, was considered a bill of credit, and therefore states were disallowed from emitting them. They had
anymore, correct. Now, so when we went through the ratification debates, the Constitution didn't forbid that they had to go and take their paper out of circulation. Mm-hmm. The intent was to replace their paper with coin.
Okay.
And so, moving to a federal and national currency instead of the state currency.
All right. So appreciate your patience, because I got one more place to take this. And I think the reason that they came up with paper in exchange for coin is, you know, if I want to move, a value of $500, I've got my pockets bulging with coins, or I've got paper and federal paper probably to represent that, correct? So that's what the states are not allowed to do, but the federal government was. In other words, if we used paper at all, did it represent coin, or are we actually expected to carry around bulging pockets of gold and silver?
Well, it's not just that. It's not just that. Read the next part.
Okay. All right. Let's see what it says. I'll start over again. That the legislatures of the individual states ought not to possess a right to emit bills of credit for a currency, or to make any tender laws for the payment or discharge of debts or contracts in any manner different from the agreement of the parties, unless for payment of the value of the thing contracted for in current money agreeable to the standard that shall be allowed by the legislature of the United States, or in any manner to obstruct or impede the recovery of debts whereby the interests of foreigners or the citizens of any other state may be affected.
Right. Okay. So what they did was they basically made it, and when you read the Constitution, because this is actually something that was included in Article 1, Section 10.
Okay.
The whole point was that they wanted to ensure that the states couldn't regulate any paper currency or any form of tender for the payment of debt.
Okay.
In other words, they wanted to get away from tobacco being currency.
Mm.
They wanted to get away from having, beef or whatever the commodity is being a tender for the payment of debt as the legal form. And what he's saying here is, whatever you want a contract, that's fine within the contract itself. In other words, it's okay if two people.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm
right
here. Okay, so it's okay if two people, like Paul, it's okay if I agree to, if you give me a pig, I will do this work for you, or I will give you, this furniture or something
right
like that. it's okay to be contracting people to people, but right. the state cannot make a law to allow anything other than gold or silver coin to be the tender for the legal payment of debt. So in right. other words, if a bank comes along and says, you know, we're willing to take your money, or you go to a store and they say, well, we're willing to take, this pig as payment, and we'll give you credit, so you can come into, our store over the next month until you've used up your credit.
Right.
They were able to do that. It didn't take away the individual right of bartering. It mm-hmm. took the state away from establishing, bartering power or anything like that. It forced the state to basically say, we can't regulate the individual trades, in other words, transactions between individuals, but we can establish that the legal tender for the payment of debt be mm-hmm. in gold and silver coin. So okay. when the state had to collect debt, mm-hmm. or when they taxed people and they said, okay, you have to pay us, then what they ended up doing was they said, okay, you have to pay us in gold or silver, period. That was the only way the state could bring in money.
Right. Okay, so paying to the state required gold or silver. So here's my next question. And again, I appreciate your patience with this, but lately states have been promulgating gold and silver currency laws. And Utah's done this. Missouri is I believe has done this or is trying to do this. And I'm asking, isn't this already in the Constitution? Why do they feel they have to do that? Am I missing something? Do you know what I'm talking about?
So I think some of these states are creating gold and silver coin as a, you're right, it's a currency law. And what it says right here is no state shall enter into any treaty, blah, 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 blah. Coin, and it says, and reprisal. And then, the next statement is coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. So
okay.
they can't coin money.
Right.
They can't coin their own money. The standards of coin, in other words, the purity of that metal, is managed and regulated, and we're out of time now. The purity of the metal in that coin is regulated by the U.S. government and minted by the U.S. government. And so these states that are passing these laws to allow them to mint is not constitutional. And somehow, there may have been rulings, or I don't know how they've gotten down this rat hole, but that's another discussion. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.